Ron Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Peter King in Orlando. Some are calling it the biggest antitrust case in 25 years. CBS News senior business and tech correspondent Joe Ling Kent says what's at stake is the basis for what Google does.
Google on defense. The Justice Department is accusing the company of monopolistic behavior, alleging it abused its power by paying $10 billion a year to be the default search engine on Apple's iPhones, Samsung Galaxies, and beyond, unfairly keeping the competition like Microsoft Bing and DuckDuckGo at bay. The DOJ says those deals cemented Google's overall dominance, creating a, quote, feedback loop that always turns to Google's advantage. The tech giant hit back, saying the government is trying to limit their ability to do business.
Federal health officials have approved a new COVID vaccine, with the CDC recommending the updated version for anyone 6 months or older, especially older people, those with compromised immune systems, and pregnant women. CBS's Alexander Tin says it'll be available quickly.
Shots are already being shipped now after the FDA moved to green light them and are expected to be available as early as Wednesday in some parts of the United States.
It's supposed to help clear your nose, but the FDA says it doesn't.
The experts say new studies show oral phenylephrine was no better than a placebo at relieving congestion. The ingredient is used in Dayquil, Sudafed, and most other cold and allergy pills. If the FDA follows through on the panel's recommendations, Johnson & Johnson, Bayer, and other drug makers could be required to pull their oral medications containing phenylephrine from store shelves.
That's CBS's Matt Piper. In Greensburg, Louisiana, one student is dead. Another, the accused shooter, is in custody. Two other students are hospitalized. It happened at the St. Helena College and Career Academy. This woman's daughter is a student there.
We're from New Orleans, so, you know, you see crime like this all the time, but for it to be smack dab in your face is very nerve-wracking.
So far, police have not released any more information, including a possible motive. Democrats say it's extreme politics. Republicans say it's a legitimate investigation. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has called for an impeachment inquiry into President Biden based on the business dealings of his son, Hunter.
This logical next step will give our committees the full power to gather all the facts and answers for the American public.
11 inches of rain in a six-hour period has pretty much put Leominster, Massachusetts, underwater since last night.
We rescued so many people last night, we don't even have a total count.
Mayor Dean Mazzarella says it was a miracle nobody died. Leominster remains under a flood watch tonight. This is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. Whitnall schools are considering a policy that would require informing parents when their children want to change their gender. At a school board meeting last night, opponents of the policy expressed their concerns following an extensive discussion. The proposed policy suggests using a student's biological sex unless parents permit their child to transition, raising concerns among some that it could negatively impact transgender students. The school board has not yet voted on the policy, and a decision date on the matter remains uncertain. There's a significant amount of wave activity on Lake Michigan today, with a beach hazard statement in effect until tonight. All area Lake Michigan beaches are impacted, including those in Racine, Milwaukee, Kenosha, Sheboygan, and Ozaukee counties. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba.
Please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Of lumping in potential allies with the fossil fuel industry and those responsible for delaying action. But in a press conference, new U.S. Open champion, 19-year-old Coco Gauff, whose semifinal match was interrupted, says she accepts climate science and sympathizes with their goals.
You know, I 100%, you know, believe in that. I think there's things that we can do better. The moments like this, yeah, are history-defining moments. And like I said, I prefer it not to happen in my match, but I wasn't pissed at, you know, the protesters. You know, I always speak about preaching about what you feel and what you believe in. And it was done in a peaceful way, so I can't get too mad at it.
Good for her. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, good day in Washington. I know the impeachment stuff, all that ridiculous nonsense, but actually something good. You know, I've got a friend who, you know, longtime friend who was born blind, and he collects, you know, SSI, the Social Security Disability Fund. And it's been helpful, but it's like $700 a month. And I often ask him, you know, how is it that you... how does you exist on a mere $700 a month? Now, you know, we're not going to get into all of that. But the reality is we've got people who are struggling just to put food on the table because of a disability. And for me, this is unacceptable. So today you saw the senators, Bill Cassidy, a Republican from Louisiana, and one of my favorite senators, Sherrod Brown from Ohio, along with Representatives Brian Higgins and Brian Fitzpatrick, introduced the SSI Savings Penalty Elimination Act. Going to maybe help people. That's why I've asked Rebecca Vallis to come talk with us. Rebecca is the senior fellow and senior advisor to the Disability Economic Justice Collaborative at the Century Foundation, also a host of the fabulous podcast Off Kilter, which I highly, highly suggest. Rebecca, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's always good to talk to you. And you're reminding me, I got to have you on Off Kilter.
Anytime, I'm always available, always willing. So let's tell me it. About this. What is this, this SSI Savings Penalty Elimination Act? What's this going to do?
Yeah, I have to say, it's nice to get to talk with you about good stuff for a change. It's been plenty of times I've been on the show talking to you about bad things that were happening in Washington. And it's nice once in a while to be able to say our elected leaders are actually working together across party lines, trying to do something that's good for workers, and in particular, good for some of the workers who have been most left behind by federal policymakers, and that's disabled workers. So the short version, and you mentioned your friend who's getting only $700 a month in SSI benefits. Well, your friend is one of about 8 million people in this country who are helped by this program, SSI, Supplemental Security Income. It's a little known part of Social Security. It gets a lot less attention than Social Security. But it exists to provide people with income that, as Congress intended it when the program was established back in the 70s, it was supposed to prevent people from living on sub-poverty incomes. Unfortunately, because the program has really been left to wither on the vine for decades, it's literally been forgotten by Congress for decades, it actually ends up trapping a whole bunch of people in poverty when it was intended to offer them a lifeline out of it. The benefits are really low, and we can talk about that another time because that's something that needs some action too. But one of the rules that's part of SSI that just hasn't been adjusted even for inflation in a long time is an asset limit, literally a savings penalty, a prohibition on having any more than $2,000 in the bank. And that applies to your friend, and that applies to all the other 8 million people who were helped by this program. That's a level that was set back in 1984. And spoiler, that's the same year I was born, Rick. So it hasn't been adjusted for inflation literally as long as I've been alive. And that is what this legislation that you mentioned and that we're talking about tonight would do, is it would update SSI's asset limit for inflation for the first time in almost 40 years. Wow. And it's actually really exciting to see bipartisan momentum for doing this, because this is a program that's been left to wither on the vine for so long.
No, you just made me feel really, really old. Because, no, in 1984, talking about myself, especially with this, is, you know, I was collecting this as a teenager. My mother passed when I was 13, and when I moved in with my grandparents, they collected. It was a meager sum. I think it was like $250 a month or something like that. But it helped put food on the table. It helped them to take care of me, to get me through, from 13 to 18. And it's one of those things that I've wanted to see strengthened. It's something that, something I share with Paul Ryan, again, somebody who has worked to destroy these programs over the years. So I think it's important to point out, when maybe we're going to maybe bump it ahead, what are the chances of this actually getting through?
Well, part of what was exciting today, and I want to be really clear, it wasn't like this bill passed any chamber of Congress. It was an introduction of this legislation, and that's kind of like getting to the starting line. But what it was it was historic to see both the Senate and the House have bipartisan teams of legislators, and you named them, coming together and saying, this is something all of us should agree on. This should not be a right issue, a left issue. This should be something we all say we need to work on. And at that press conference where the senators and the members of Congress were unveiling this legislation, they had a really interesting, strange bedfellows crew of supporters with them that gives me a lot of hope that this might actually be a bill that actually does move. We saw AARP up there with JP Morgan Chase, up there with Microsoft, up there with the National Association of Evangelicals and the Bipartisan Policy Center. The Chamber of Commerce has even endorsed this legislation. And that makes me feel a little different than your average piece of legislation that has to do with cutting poverty and actually expanding opportunity for people. Because instead of it being a bunch of Democrats all flanked by folks who all work at anti-poverty organizations like me, this was a bunch of folks saying, you know what, no matter what walk of life you come from, it should be honestly a no-brainer that the federal government should not be in the business of punishing people for saving money. And we certainly shouldn't be trapping people in poverty because the federal government is telling you you can't have more than $2,000 in the bank. That's not even enough to have emergency savings. That's not even enough to save up for a security deposit to move into an apartment, right? So there's all these different ramifications that were never intended by Congress because, honestly, they set these limits back in 1984, again, the year I was born, and they intended for them to go up. They just forgot to index them to inflation. So that's why you saw members of Congress who honestly don't agree on much else coming together and saying, this is something we all need to work on. And you saw the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Ron Wyden, saying, you know what? We need to find any available piece of legislation that's moving through the Senate to attach this to. 70% of Americans across party lines, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, everybody in between agree that updating SSI's asset limits is something that we need to do. And frankly, 60% of Americans think there shouldn't be an asset limit in SSI at all. So this is really something everybody can agree on. And when I'm agreeing with people at the American Enterprise Institute, and just like you're saying, you don't agree with Paul Ryan on much, that gives me some hope that this might actually be something Congress wants to do.
So what are they talking to move this limit out? Are they talking about eliminating it, as you've said a moment ago, or is there a number? Because, you know, I looked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation calculator, and had that $2,000 from 1984 kept up with inflation, it would be about $6,000. It'd be $6,000 today. What are they talking about moving it up to?
So they're actually talking about moving it up to $10,000 for an individual and $20,000 for a couple. Is that everything I would like to see them do? No. I would love to see there be no asset limit in SSI at all, because honestly, we shouldn't be having the federal government in the business of trying to find a needle in a haystack to keep people away from, honestly, as you were saying before, survival benefits, right? $700, which is more than a lot of people get. The average SSI benefit is actually less than that. That's not enough for anyone to live on. And so also trapping people in all kinds of red tape and saying you can't save, you can't get married, you can't get help from a friend. I mean, there's all kinds of rules in SSI that need to be updated. This is just one. But what this bill would do is to update these limits to $10,000 for an individual, $20,000 for a couple. And the fact that we're seeing this level of bipartisan and cross-sector agreement on this issue, I mean, again, the Chamber of Commerce endorsed this bill today, and that's a pretty big deal given that this is a piece of anti-poverty legislation that actually has a, you know, a cost to it. That gives me some hope that this is a compromise that Congress actually wants to advance.
No, that is a good thing. I mean, we could debate the means testing. You know, I don't know that I want Elon Musk collecting it, but, you know, look, because I look at, you know, I look at people like my friend. I go back to my grandparents. You know, it was a struggle taking me on, and it was a meager benefit. It was, I was grateful for it, and I'm sure they were too. But it's something that as a society, I think, you know, as you said, it's hard to make a living, hard to just exist. You know, I was just, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, a person that I knew who had, they had diabetes young, they went blind, they had transplants, they had all kinds of stuff that went on, and ended up having to live kind of in a halfway house because they couldn't afford to live on their own. And, and I don't know that that's good either.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly the situation. And, you know, hey, I'm not going to get into a whole thing about means testing with you right now either, but SSI is also means tested in addition to having this really, really harsh savings penalty. So, you know, in my opinion, everyone always is telling us, right, you got to save responsibly, you got to save for the future. But at the same time, you got the federal government talking out of the other side of its mouth and saying, just kidding, you got to choose between having even basic emergency savings and being able to have survival income and health insurance. And that's a choice nobody should have to make.
Yeah. So how can we help move this along? How can we help make sure that that this gets passed through and, you know, Sherrod and Cassidy and get this through the Senate and Higgins and Fitzpatrick, get it through the House? I mean, I think the House could be, you know, interesting, but how do we help do that?
Yeah, so the number one thing that folks can do, and your listeners are always very, very accustomed to being told to take action, that's one of the reasons I love your show so much, is they can tell their member of Congress that they should support the SSI Savings Penalty Elimination Act. The champions of this bill, as you mentioned, they're looking for co-sponsors. They're looking for other friends in both chambers of Congress to work with them to actually build further support for this bill and to be able to get it to a point where it can actually be attached to some kind of piece of legislation that's going to move. There's not a lot in Washington that is actually moving forward right now. In fact, we're on the brink of a government shutdown and other things because we see so much gridlock and we see so little that left and right are able to agree on. And that's before we get to talking about impeachment and anything else, right? We've heard Speaker McCarthy. I mean, the list goes on. This is one of those rare areas of potential bipartisan cooperation. And again, it's not very often I come on your show and say I'm agreeing with Andrew Biggs over at the American Enterprise Institute, but he just wrote a piece in Forbes saying this is a rare area of bipartisan cooperation to actually do something to help increase opportunity in this country. So
I'm curious, you know, what is it that makes them, what gets them on board? I mean, look, there are moral reasons that I support it. I want to make sure that people can keep food on the table, a roof over their head, have some dignity and respect and all this, because I've seen how people have struggled because of how low these payments are. Why is the American Enterprise Institute, who's generally the ones who are willing to kick somebody out of their wheelchair, as we've seen, you know, here in Harrisburg when they were trying to eliminate a lot of the disability funding? What is it that brings them to this? What is the economic gain there for them then? That's where my mind goes.
It's such a great question. And I think it's because everyone who's now been looking at this, and this is social insurance and economic policy experts across the political spectrum, are looking at this and saying, you know what, this is actually bad economic policy. This is hamstringing people from being able to save, which is something that we know, whether you're on the right or the left or anywhere in between, is actually something that encourages economic stability. When people are able to have savings, we have all kinds of research on this, they're less likely to fall into poverty, right? Because they're able to have that backstop. And so given that saving for the future is one of those key Republican cornerstone talking points, right? Save responsibly. I mean, I got to say it with my Republican voice, right? That is actually a thing that they want people to be able to do. And given that Congress never intended these limits to stay so low, they just forgot to index this to inflation. It's not like, you know, it's not like you're seeing AEI say, let's eliminate these asset limits. They're saying, let's just update them to where they would be for inflation to fix that error that Congress made. And that was what we heard Bill Cassidy say in this press conference today. He said, you know what? It was an oversight on the part of Congress back in 1972 when they established this program. And I should say SSI was signed into law by President Nixon of all people, right? This isn't some lefty program. This was a bipartisan program from the beginning, but this was before Congress really understood, policymakers really understood the importance of indexing key programs to inflation. That came later. And so as Bill Cassidy said, no lefty, right? Republican from Louisiana. As he said today in this press conference, this is about going back and fixing that oversight from Congress from before. And so we got to update the limits to inflation where they would have been, right? Where Congress legislated back in the 70s and the 80s. And we also need to index these limits to inflation moving forward so that we don't have to come back and fix this problem again. So it really isn't some outrageous idea. It's pretty common sense. And that's why you're seeing so much agreement on it. But I think you're seeing a lot of folks on the right say, let's do this, because they're realizing it's actually getting in the way of economic growth. And it's getting in the way of people like major corporations like JP Morgan Chase and Microsoft, some of the supporters of this bill, hiring disabled people, right? And everyone right now is realizing we have a worker shortage. Everyone's talking about what can we do about that. So I think that's some of why you're seeing groups like them get on board as well.
No, it sounds plausible. And for me, the idea of allowing people to have some savings, especially as we have a Republican House that wants to keep shutting the government down, it's important, especially if you're getting payments from the government, it's important to have a little bit of savings, a little safety net, a little cushion for when they do it the next time. So I'm all on board. I hope folks will contact their representatives and say, hey, get that SSI Savings Penalty Elimination Act. There's got to be a better name for that. Get that through. But Rebecca, I appreciate the time. Please come back again real soon.
And I'm going to have you on Off Kilter soon, Rick. It's overdue. So I'm going to send you a little link so that it can make it real easy for folks to get involved and contact their representatives. And I'll have you tweet that out to make this nice and easy.
Outstanding. Thank you so much.
We'll talk soon.
Rebecca Vallis, senior fellow and senior advisor to the Disability Economic Justice Collaborative over at the Century Foundation. TCF.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Also, make sure you check out her podcast. Fabulous stuff. It's called Off Kilter with Rebecca Vallis. We'll get links out. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, when you look at the safety net that we have left in this country, And I'm grateful. I've talked about this before. There have been over the years numerous programs that I benefited from. You know, the Johnson Great Society stuff that helped make sure that we had school lunches. Granted, they weren't great, but they were there. I remember as a kid, going to Purtis Elementary School, in the summertime with all of the other kids and lining up for lunch. There was a lunch program. And for a lot of those kids, it was the only hot meal that they had that day. And one of the things that Reagan and the Republican Revolution came with was destroying those. It's one of the first things that got cut was all of those programs that fed poor kids. And you go, well, that's not true. No, I lived it. I watched it happen. Mr. Ketchup is a Vegetable literally took food out of the mouths of the kids that I grew up with. And at every turn, what we've seen is Republicans and conservative Democrats. Conservative, we love the children, care about life, pro-life folks, with policies that make it much harder for people who are struggling to make ends meet, and the disabled being part of that. I remember when Tom Corbett was elected governor here in Pennsylvania, and it's one of those moments. There are moments in your life that are just burnt into your brain. And there was a woman from in one of the disability groups who was in a wheelchair. She had all kinds of things going wrong. And she said, look, they are trying to cut the meager. I mean, it was like $100 a month or something that she got from the state. They're trying to cut what pays for me just to get some bit of food on the table. And they're trying to cut, all of these different programs she was talking about. And she said, look, if they're going to kill me, they're going to have to watch me do it in public. And I remember thinking, we're the richest country in the world at the richest moment in time. How is this happening? How is this possible? And who puts up with this? And it's one of those reasons that, I look at these programs and go, we need to strengthen them. And I've had people go, there are people who cheat the system. Sorry, I'm not buying that. Every person I've known who's got these benefits desperately, desperately needed them. And it's infuriating when you hear people, they got something I didn't. Now look, I pay a lot of taxes and I'm happy to do that. I'm fortunate in that I make a reasonable wage. Got a good union job. I do very well. I'm happy to pay the taxes because I know it's going to benefit people. Because I think of that 10-year-old kid that I once was. And I think about that kid that's growing up in the same place that I grew up in. Do they have the same opportunities? Are they enduring the same struggles? Because look, you wouldn't know it by looking at me, but when I was a kid, the cupboards were always bare. End of the month, food stamps didn't go that far. And I remember going, this isn't how it should be. So when I go back to where we started today, $250 a month for kids over six, $300 a month for kids under six. Cut poverty down to 5% for children. We take that away, it has more than doubled. It's almost two and a half times increase in the poverty level. Almost, 12.5% now? And we're talking about a meager amount of money that made an enormous difference. Because again, I think back to what would have an extra $100 a month meant to my mother in putting food on our table and keeping a roof over our head? What would that meager amount of money have done? What bit of dignity would it have given her? And I guess the reason I get angry about this is because it is personal. Because I remember my mother looking at me, knowing there's nothing she can do to put food on the table, knowing I was hungry. And before we had kids, and I waited until I was in my mid-30s before we began having a family. That was one of the things that I said, never going to happen.
It's never going to happen. I'm never going to look at my children and know that they're hungry and there's nothing I can do about it. And as a society, what is wrong with us that we would be okay with that? What is wrong with all of those people who preach to us about abortion and about being pro-life? What is wrong with these people that they wouldn't demand that every child, everyone, go to bed with a full belly? That's the minimum. I'm not even talking about healthcare and education and opportunity and all the other things that as a parent I want and strive for my kids. The very simple bit of ensuring that people have the ability to put food on their table, which again, you know, for the American Enterprise Institute is a great thing. And for the Chamber of Commerce is a great thing because eventually that money trickles up, as all money does. It trickles up to the big corporations because you got to buy the food from somewhere. So it seems like a win-win. People get fed, fat cats get fatter. Sounds like a win-win. But no, we're going to make those working people lazy and not desperate enough. Again, back to our CEO who said, you know what, we need mass unemployment. We need misery in the economy so we get those working people back in line. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast, share it with your friends. I'll highly suggest that. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1997. That was the day that Union Square in New York City was named a National Historic Landmark. Republican Governor George Pataki explained the importance of the park in a press release. It is only fitting that the National Park Service should recognize Union Square Park's long history as a focal point for political expression. New York is proud that the first Labor Day parade took place here in Union Square Park more than 100 years ago, establishing a tradition that spread across the nation. Although the park was very important to the labor movement, that was not why it was known as Union Square. The park got its name because it was the place of intersection or union of two busy New York roads, what are today Broadway and Fourth Avenue. In 1831, the open space at the intersection was declared a public space. The space became an important location for labor rallies and political demonstrations. In 1882, the first Labor Day parade in U.S. history marched through the square, 10,000 workers waving their banners high. In 1911, union workers again gathered at Union Square to protest after the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire killed 146, mostly young women and girls, some garment workers as young as 11 and 14 years old. In the later 1920s, the park was demolished for construction of the New York subway, but the space continued to be important to the city's union movement. In 2002, a series of 22 bronze plaques were dedicated at the park to tell the history of Union Square. One of those plaques tells of the first Labor Day parade. Another is a collage of images of labor demonstrations and sheet music of labor songs. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Back to school. Bright-eyed youngsters are now back in our public classrooms, filled with questions about the world around them. Questions like, what happened to our school library? And where did our librarians go? Sadly, these wholly beneficial, caring educators are being dumped in school trash bins by loopy right-wing ideologues who are out to impose their bigotry and ignorance on America. They've been on a rampage of banning books and demonizing teachers, but now the extremists are saying that's not stupid enough. Let's also launch a witch hunt against librarians. This authoritarian assault, funded by a clique of far-right billionaires and coordinated by their front groups, has been popping off across the country. But leave it to Texas Governor Greg Abbott to push it from extreme to totalitarianism. He has unilaterally seized control of Houston's school district, the largest, most diverse in Texas, installing his own whip-cracking dictatorial overseer. Mike Miles, a former Army Ranger and CEO of a corporate school chain, promptly decreed that to improve reading scores in his district, he would first eliminate librarians from 28 schools in Black and Latino neighborhoods and, second, turn their libraries into centers where students who misbehave will be disciplined. Also, Abbott's education czar demands that all teachers there must reapply for their jobs, agree to follow a centrally scripted curriculum, and be monitored by classroom cameras. Of course, elimination of independent educational resources and regimentation of instruction will reduce schools to state institutions for obedience training. This is Jim Hightower saying, and that's the point. The GOP's push to remake education is a billionaire's wet dream of a compliant, subservient workforce. Don't ask questions, just keep pulling that plow.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're ticking down the days to potential strike with the UAW. Midnight on the 14th is the end of the contract, and I've been told that that's a deadline, that, you know, on the 15th they're going on strike. And the news coverage of this has been quite interesting. The idea that Sean Fain is the union boss, they do this all the time. No, he was democratically elected by the members as their representative. He's not the boss. The bosses are the big three. Those are the bosses. These are the workers who create the wealth that the bosses put in their pocket. And you look at the first half of this year, the big three automakers have made a combined $23 billion in profits. Our CEO class, they've put into their pockets, what, General Motors, $29 million in his pocket last year. Ford CEO, $21 million in his pocket. The CEO of Stellantis, $25 million in his pocket. But no, we can't give those workers who pay their salary, who make the wages to pay their salary, can't help them. And I love the fact that Sean Fain has chosen that 46% increase number, because that's what the CEOs have put in their pocket. And here to share some thoughts on what's happening and maybe what happens on the 15th, I've asked our good friend Frank Hammer to come talk with us. The Hammer is back, retired UAW GM, international representative, and former UAW 909 president. Frank, thanks for taking time for us.
Greetings. Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
So I want to get to this frame of this. One of these things that tick me off all the time, you know, it's the union bosses. You get a picture of them with a fat cigar sitting in an ivory tower, like a CEO. This is not who these folks are.
Yeah, they're stuck in the past.
Now,
UAW's changed, and they're not wanting to give the union credit for the fact that it's changed and it's a rank and file from the bottom up type of organization. That's the direction it's taking. And they want to appeal to the public at large as if it was a corrupt union. It's not.
But you know, at the end of the day, this is about workers who create the wealth that these shareholders, that these CEOs are overwhelmingly putting in their own pockets. And for me, this is one of those reasons why I'm a union person. Look, these workers don't deserve a raise. They earn it. They don't deserve better benefits. They earn it by the work that they do and the product that they produce, so that these companies can put this kind of profit in their pockets.
Yeah. So, it's extraordinary. And I just want to say, you're performing a great service by being a medium through which the rank and file point of view gets out, because the corporate media has really been slamming the UAW for the preposterous demands that they're making. But they never tell the real story about what it's like to be an auto worker these days. And I can tell you from my own experience, I mean, I left my plant in 1995, and what the workers are describing today has no commonality with my experience. Workers today are really suffering, and there's so many different ways that that's happened. And we now have a leadership in the UAW saying, We don't have to put up with the suffering. We can fight back. And like you said, it ain't a question about deserving. It's a question of what we earned and the value that workers are producing for the corporations.
Now, earlier when I started the program, I talked about a CEO who came out and said, look, we need pain in the economy. We need more unemployment. We need a recession. We need to get those workers back into line because they think that we need them more than they need us. Is that one of these scenarios, you think?
Well, that's certainly the picture that they're painting. And I have to say, corporate class is already out there, for example, Stellantis, threatening that if the workers are demanding what's just, we'll just move our work to Mexico. And that is the kind of leverage that they want to use against workers. We know that they've done it in the past. You know, they threatened Flint. Look at Flint today. You know, a lot of the factory is left Flint. Look at Detroit. And so they hold this threat over our heads, and it really requires a different approach of internationalism, and I believe that Sean Fain and the UAW is moving in that direction.
Now, this is something, but this is something I've talked about, you know, for decades now, this idea that we do need to work across borders and ensure that jobs, wherever they go, are good-paying union jobs, where, so that these companies can't, you know, run around the globe looking for cheap labor. And we need trade policies that ensure that we don't allow them to go to countries to be able to pump, dump back things back into this country, as they were trying in China. But in looking at this moment, you know, if the UAW gets what they want, if what they're asking for, a 46% wage increase, which, you know, it does not seem outrageous when you look at the starting rate is about $17 an hour for an auto worker. And you get a 32-hour work week, which could filter across the economy. What would it cost the big three? What, you know, what would it cost them in the massive profits that they're getting, or do we not know?
Well, there are calculations. I don't have them at hand, but even at if workers made $32 across the board, you know, it's like collectively together, it's a pittance compared to the profits that they've made, which is like a quarter of $1 trillion over the last 10 years made by the three companies. So it's a real cheap cry of poverty on the part of the corporations. And really, it's a question, do we want to have a working class in the U.S. that will support the economy? And if so, how do we support the economy? By jobs that pay well, and that enable workers to support the economy, which is what we need, we need. The companies need it, too. It's their contradiction.
Yeah, it comes back to my question all the time is, you know, what are you first? Are you a worker first or a consumer first? You know, and I hear people all the time, well, you know, if they get these raises, the price of cars are going to go up. You know, what's it going to cost the economy if they go on strike? And, you know, my mind doesn't work in that way as much. You know, for me is, you know, what happens if they don't go on strike? What happens if they don't, in this moment, get what they earn? And again, I look at the last several contract negotiations that have been not great. This is just kind of making up for lost ground, not even moving them further ahead of where they should already be, I think.
Yeah, we're in a moment now where we're looking back to 10 years ago and more when we had the bailout, the Wall Street financial crisis, and then the bailout. And the bailout is commonly misunderstood as the companies were temporarily asking us for concessions in order that they could get back on their feet in the wake of losing their market share from 17 million to 10 million cars. And everybody thinks that, well, now that we're on good ground and the companies are back on their feet, well, they're going to just compensate us back for what we lost. Wrong. Their intent was to restructure the industry. The title of the book of the chief of the auto bailout instrument that the Obama administration used was overhaul. They wanted to overhaul the industry, and they used that moment of the crisis to do it. So you're absolutely right. We are only trying to recoup the things that they took away from us. For example, they stopped COLA payments out of the bankruptcy. They stop having health care for new future retirees in the bailout. They stop pensions for current workers during the bailout. So these were all things that were used to restructure the relationship between the auto industry and the workers. It was done under both the Republican, Bush, and the Democrat, Obama, along with Joe Biden at his side. And we are now confronted with recouping these losses as a result of that so-called overhaul. So that's where we are now. Yes.
But Frank, you know, I have my Republican friends who tell me that the auto workers got a sweetheart deal. Now, look, I say all the time, it's the first time that any company went through, you know, a bankruptcy where the workers didn't get their screwed out of their pensions. But I'm told it was the great sweetheart deal that the auto workers, you know, it was Obama gave a huge payout to the auto workers. I'm hearing what you're saying is different.
Well, yeah. And of course, that's debatable, of course. And their big claim is that the existing current workers at that moment in time did not lose their pensions. And that's a true statement. That's true. That we did not lose our pensions. I retain my pension. People, the workers at the moment, but future
workers. Yes, you should.
The future, right. But the future workers, they were denied pensions. Currently, a current worker on the shop floor making $16.67 an hour, okay, is looking down the pike to when they retire, and there will be no pension. They get this flimsy 401k, they get no pension. They get no health care. So you can talk about a sweetheart deal. Yeah, the current workforce at the time did retain their pensions, but man, it was at a huge cost to the workers that were the new workers that had come into the plants at that point in time.
Yeah. So here's the thing, and this is where, you know, in fact, I just had a guest earlier who said, you know, the auto jobs are a major driver for the economy because, you know, they help create other jobs and people want to emulate those jobs. So it sounds like, you know, we've got an economy based on you know, jobs that are diminishing as the auto worker jobs have. And this is an opportunity that I think Sean Fain and the UAW is taking to say, no, look, we want to be that driver of good jobs again. We want to be that driver of family sustaining wage jobs, if I'm getting this right.
Yeah, that's the mission. And what we're confronted with is that in the meantime, the industry is converting to electric vehicles, as you all know.
Right.
And they're looking at that conversion, that transition to the electric vehicles as another way to shave the UAW, as another way to create a new tier, a new lower tier of a workforce. They want to pay like max $20-$21 an hour for workers that are doing the same kind of work that I was doing. And man, when I retired when I left the plant in 1995, I was making $30 an hour. So how is it that here we are 20 years later and workers are only supposed to make $20 an hour? Isn't there something called inflation that would have at least kept the workers at the same level as I was in that economy in 1995? Not the case. So that's what we're up against.
It's crazy. So let me ask you this. You know, we're looking at this deadline, which is coming up very quickly on the 14th at midnight. I've been reading some reports that, you know, negotiations are happening. There's some movement. Are we hopeful that this can be avoided? Do you expect a strike? Some of the members that I've talked to are geared up and ready to go, much like the UPS workers were when the Teamsters were negotiating. If you look into your crystal ball, what do you see?
Well, let me tell you, first of all, that in my union career, I have never seen the kind of level of enthusiasm and preparedness that I'm seeing and hearing among fellow auto workers that are currently in the plants. They're ready to strike. They are ready to strike. And I think I don't think that you're going to see any kind of tentative agreement in the next couple of days, because there are a lot of musts in this new agreement. Eliminating the entire tier structure. It's not just two tiers. It's multiple tiers, multiple working agreements for different levels of workers. It's so complex. It takes a lawyer to figure it out now. We have the lack of, you know, like I was mentioning earlier, the lack of pensions, the lack of health care for retiring workers under these contracts. All these musts are going to make these negotiations extremely difficult. I don't see them happening before the midnight September 14th, and I see people walking out and picketing and being out in front of their factories with their signs. Everybody tier one, et cetera, et cetera. There are too many demands making up for the losses that we've already taken, plus the demands for our future work in the electrified industry that I don't see the agreement coming out of the September 14th.
Well, we will see how this works itself out. The hope is that, well, let me ask you that. I was going to say the hope is the Biden administration steps back and let this go. Do you expect anything from the Biden administration? I mean, as I've been saying, I think Joe's is the most pro-labor president of my lifetime. I'm hoping he does what FDR did back during his administration, just said, hey, they'll work it out. Do you expect anything from the administration?
Well, I know that Biden said that, the party should come out with a fair agreement. I have no idea what he intends with that. I think that there's a lot of pressure coming from Wall Street on Biden and the Biden and the Democratic Party establishment doesn't want to see any dislocations to the U.S. economy. So I think there's going to be a lot of pressure coming from the administration for a premature settlement or for a settlement that doesn't satisfy all of the UAW demands. What I think Biden should be doing is he should be out there campaigning for a raise in the minimum wage. We have not had a raise in the minimum wage in 13 years. Yeah. We're still at $7.25 an hour. And he's got to raise the floor to a new level and let the Republicans fight against the raise in the minimum wage. But that's where workers are hurting all over the country. And that's what he can do to contribute to a successful outcome for the UAW strike.
I'm right there with you. That's actually 14 years. Last time it was raised was 2009.
Thank you. Thank you.
And in my state of Pennsylvania, the last time the state raised it was 2006. So, the law here is still 715. So we're even further behind, but we get the federal. But I'm looking forward to seeing how this works out. I am hoping that an agreement is reached. I'm hoping it's everything that the workers earn. But ultimately, if a strike comes, I wish them the best. One day longer, one day stronger. But Frank, I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and keep us informed as this continues.
Thank you. I'll be happy to.
Good stuff, our good friend Frank Hammer. I want to hear your thoughts. What do you think of this? Is this something Biden should get involved in? Should he step back and just let them hammer it out? And what if it does trigger some bit of economic pain? Should it matter? And what if they agree to something worse? I'm in the mindset, let them work it out, fight it out, and get the best deal possible. Back after this with your thoughts. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. Socialist and labor leader Eugene V. Debs was sentenced to 10 years in prison for opposing the United States' involvement in World War I. The Espionage and Sedition Act had been passed a year earlier. This made it a criminal offense to interfere with military recruitment efforts. Debs made a speech at a socialist convention in Canton, Ohio, that was considered a violation of this act. He said, "They have always taught and trained you to believe it is your patriotic duty to go to war and have yourself slaughtered at their command. But in all the history of the world, you, the people, have never had a voice in declaring war." Debs also noted, "The master class has always declared the wars, the subject class has always fought the battles." Debs refused to take the stand in his own defense at his trial. He admitted to obstructing the war effort, saying the war did nothing for working people. Debs ran for president as a socialist in 1920 while in jail. Many of his campaign buttons read, "Convict number 9653. During his run, Debs received 1 million votes.
Debs was released from the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary in 1921. Many agreed with his assertion that the working class have never been the ones to profit from war. In 1935, two-time Medal of Honor recipient and U.S. Marine Corps Major General Smedley Darlington Butler published a book titled War is a Racket, which outlined the excesses of the corporate class over the workers. Many look at the 2003 Iraq invasion by President Bush as another example. Halliburton, a multinational corporation, made nearly $40 billion from its involvement in that war. It's doubtful that any working class people have ever made that kind of profit from war. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So look, you know, again, you know, today's big news, obviously, the impeachment inquiry that's going to happen. Republicans are going to have to show their cards at some point and show that there's nothing going to be there. But as I've said, I think the bigger part of this is the fact that in this moment, Republicans have chose to weaponize impeachment instead of actually do something about poverty numbers. To actually, you know, again, this is the part that's incredibly insane to me. Smart policy, sound investment can make people's lives better. It's that simple, especially when you're talking about the children that my pro-life crowd, I shouldn't say that, my anti-abortion crowd, they seem to be fixated on. They love the babies. But when they become children, the heck with them. They can go to work. We can put them in factories. If they're hungry enough, you know, we'll put them to work. Think about where the conservative mindset is taking us. Consider where we're going policy-wise with a Republican-controlled House. What legislation have they brought? Because understand, you know, the things that you do when you're in the majority, when you know that you don't have a chance of passing it, are your priorities. They're your values. They're message bills. What message legislation have Republicans moved on? Well, look, when Democrats were in control of the House and Republicans had the Senate and the White House, and there was no chance of something passing, what did they do? They sought to increase opportunities for health care, for education, for higher minimum wages, for better opportunities to organize. They had legislation. They had priorities. They had great messaging bills to say, hey, working people, get behind this. If you put us into power, if you give us the votes that we need, this is the stuff that we will move. What are Republicans, what sale are they making? What are they telling we, the American voters? What are their priorities? Their priorities are holding the government hostage. We're not going to pay our bills. The government is literally not going to pay its bills. What are their priorities? We're going to impeach Joe Biden for, we don't know what yet, but we'll find out. We'll find something. And look, it's not about, I don't think there'll ever be an impeachment vote. I don't think so. What this is, quite frankly, is a dog and pony show. This is bread and circus. This is just so that they can hold hearings and bring up all kinds of bad things and then blow it out of proportion for their talk radio dominant medium, for their cable news voices, for all of the right media that's out there that's just, well, doing the daily outrage, getting people upset over things that may be accurate, maybe not. But for me, I come back to, yeah, all of the entertainment, all of the shenanigans, all of the bread and circus, all of the play. There are still children who go to bed hungry every night. There are still families who are struggling. There are still working people who are getting cheated out of wages. There are still things that aren't being done. And that's what infuriates me.
The fact that 5 million kids fell into poverty last year. The fact that because of Republican ideology and policy, we had the largest one-year increase in poverty on record. Let that sink in for a minute. Think about what priorities you have to have. To say, you know, all this other stuff is more important. Attacking our political enemy. More important than feeding those children that we so claim we love. It's crazy.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.